Hey there, and welcome back to Preoccupied. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Edelstein of the University of Michigan, talking about personality and social psychology.
Yep, so I'm sure all of you have seen on Facebook these wonderful personality profiles that go around, backed by enormous amounts of research and put out by the most knowledgeable of people in the field of personality, those guys over at BuzzFeed.
Oh, yeah. So Zenon and I wanted to do some firsthand investigation on these measures of personality, you know. So we've got a couple really insightful self-discoveries that we've been looking at. Zenon, so if you had to look at yourself and say if you were, I don't know, a taco or a burrito, which one do you relate to more according to some of these measures?
I mean, this is a question that I've struggled over long and hard. But BuzzFeed has helped me to find this self-discovery, and I am indeed a taco.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Yep. According to this quiz on BuzzFeed, it's because I have a bit of a tough side, but I'm also a little sweet, and I have the solution for every problem.
That's so you. Oh my god.
isn't it? Now, Maddie, I don't know. How about you? How are you, a taco or a burrito?
Well, you know, in my eating habits, I tend to lean towards tacos, but in my own personal day-to-day life, my interactions with other people, the way I connect with others, apparently I am actually a burrito. This is because I am a bit soft. This is true. I am quite sensitive. But I know how to hold my own. I'm the one in the friend group that holds everything together.
What do you know?
I know. It's just
one
like
of the podcast.
How could they even be able to tell that? That's crazy.
Yep. From questions such as, are you more of a dog or a cat person? Or which famous mall do you want to visit? They can figure out which Tex-Mex food that you
want. Yeah. But, like, what I really wanted to know is which Scandinavian country, well, not the one that I would visit. No, not the one that I would visit, but which one I am,
exactly.
You know?
Like, if you were to be the citizen of a Scandinavian country, which one would it be, Maddie?
Apparently, I most like Denmark because I'm vibrant and lively or whatever. And I love exploring museums, castles, and royal palaces. And I guess just leaves me in Denmark, you know?
Yep. Well, I'm apparently most like Norway because I'm bright, bold, and love being around nature. And get this fits me perfectly. You would enjoy gazing at the Northern Lights.
What? You know, that's not something that a lot of people can say. That's pretty special.
Yeah, it really is. I don't know. And here's another one. You hear all this talk about Gen Z and the new generation taking things over, so we took this inventory that tells us what percent Gen Z we are. So,
you know, something that you would think is as black and white as being born past, what is it, 2000?
Yeah, something like that. I'm here it says 95.
Oh, past 95. But actually, it's a lot more complex than that. How a Gen Z you are is apparently on more of a spectrum than, like, anything. Apparently, I am 67% Gen Z because I am a fan of individual expression over group mentality, and I am apparently always on my phone, and I need to go on a stroll in the park. What about you, Zenon? Are you...
Well, I am apparently only 42% Gen Z.
What a bad Gen Zer you are.
I know. It asks about these things like, what was it, cancel culture?
Yeah.
And yeah, I had to pick the I don't know what that is option. So, yeah, there's some things that Gen Zers agree with that I completely agree with, but then others I'm on the fence about,
mm-hmm.
like social media. So, and there we go, 15 minutes past the hour,
yeah.
What do you know?
But in all seriousness, there are actually ways for psychologists to measure certain aspects of personality, which is kind of cool, kind of a bummer, because we all like to think, like, oh, I'm so special and nuanced, but, like, actually, there are things like, for example, the Big Five personality test, which we're going to leave in the show notes for you to take yourself. And there are a couple factors that it looks at.
Yep. It's generally considered the most reliable of any personality assessment because of all the research that's gone into it and the traits that it measures. The first is, well, these go in kind of an acronym, OCEAN, O-C-E-A-N. So the first one being openness to experience.
And that's kind of like, is that like extroversion?
No, extroversion's its own thing. Oh. Openness to experience covers things like being willing to try new things and expand your...
horizons.
Yeah, expand your horizons and your expectations. You know, being willing to accept new ideas. And then people low in openness would be kind of set in their ways and traditional.
And then people who are higher up in openness, you know, are probably...
open to new experiences.
Open to new experiences! Oh!
Yep, in case you can't tell, we're not cutting anything this time. Going through one take.
Yeah. Right. Full send.
Yep. Conscientiousness. You want to tell us a bit about conscientiousness, Maddie?
Conscientiousness... not to be confused with consciousness, as I did when Googling it, is a personality trait all about being careful or diligent, like, with your work. And, like, so when you have a task to do, you want to do it well, and you want to do it efficiently and in an organized way.
So kind of like work ethic, almost.
Yeah. Yeah, like, if you're kind of a perfectionist, then maybe... you would be higher up in conscientiousness as well.
Yeah. And then if you're low in conscientiousness, you're impulsive and disorganized, maybe more prone to taking risks.
Like me. Who is in the 18th percentile for conscientiousness, so that's pretty low.
Well, I'm in the 62nd percentile, so...
makes sense. Yep. When you and I exchange papers, like... you find, somehow, in my works cited pages, you'll find a comma that's, like, supposed to be a period. I'm like, what the hell, dude? Like, how do you see that?
Yeah. And then, kind of with the openness to experience and the imagination, I'll hand you my paper, and you'll be like, well, you could look at this way instead. And I'm like, you know, that's a much better way to express that idea. Thank you. So, this shows that personality traits aren't necessarily good or bad.
Exactly.
But they can serve different purposes in different scenarios.
Yes. And it's nice when you have friends that complement your own.
Definitely.
So we got the O and the C for ocean.
So that means E comes next, which is extroversion.
Yeah, what can you tell us about extroversions, Lennon? What are you... you're like an expert extrovert, no?
Oh, totally. I'm an expert in why I am in no way extroverted, as I come in the 7th percentile of extroversion.
Yeah.
Which is pretty darn low. So to kind of explain what extroversion is, it's the quality of being outgoing and social, and like wanting to be around lots of people, maybe having a lot of people that you know and regularly communicate or spend time with. Whereas introverts, like I guess me, are more likely to have...
you could have told us that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, hey, according to the Big Five, right, mm-hmm. in my 7th percentile extroversionist, I would be very introverted, meaning that I don't have a ton of friends that I'm always spending time with. I have maybe a few friends who are a lot closer than, say, an extrovert might have.
Right. Like, I can definitely say that, you know, I have... one or two best friends that I talk to every day. And then the rest is just like a really, like a bigger circle of people who I talk to every once in a while. But I would say,
yeah.
Like, but maintaining those relationships in that wider circle is a bit easier for me because I am in the 88th percentile for extroversion kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So that brings us to the A in ocean. So, Maddie, what does the A stand for here?
Agreeableness is like cooperativeness. What's the word? Cooperativity? Cooperation!
There you go. Cooperation. That works. Yeah.
And one of the questions on this test asked, do you use big vocabulary words? Like, I invent my own sometimes, so I don't know what that means. But, yeah, so high agreeableness is also high levels of cooperation. This also says, is, like, more sympathetic, more kind.
Yep. friendly, optimistic.
Right. Yep. So I'm pretty proud to say I am in the 93rd percentile for agreeableness.
Which
I'm also
is very high.
Yeah. I'm also a total people pleaser, and sometimes my high agreeableness will result in me not getting what I want or need. Zenon, however, doesn't play with that shit. You know, he knows what he wants.
Yeah, I'm in the first percentile for agreeableness, which, in case you're not familiar with percentiles, they range from 1 to 99, and 1 is as low as you can possibly score.
And I'm sure if you've ever had a class with Zenon, taught him, or anything like that, you're like, yeah, that sounds about...
Yeah, so people low in agreeableness, like myself, may tend to not spend as much time being concerned about the feelings of others, and may sometimes inadvertently be insulting, or, end up making people feel bad. So, again, my apologies for being overly critical. But that also comes from the conscientiousness, right?
Yes.
Let's see. After agreeableness...
Okay. We need the
comes,
N.
Yep, neuroticism, which is an absolutely awful word.
Yeah.
In that, yeah.
These days we call it emotional stability, but when we say neuroticism, like, you know what.
So, like, and... Mean. Yeah, so people who are neurotic, according to the Big Five, may have, like, mood swings or be prone to anxiety and worry. Mm-hmm. And
you get worked up pretty easily.
Yeah, exactly. They're, like, very negatively emotional, as some things put it.
Yeah, so a high level of, you know, emotionality and things like that.
Yep, so some of these things may sound like characteristics of mental illness, but having high neuroticism does not necessarily mean that you're mentally ill, although there is a bit of a correlation there.
But you're probably fine.
Yeah, definitely. Yep, no need to worry.
You've probably also heard about the Myers-Briggs test. That's the thing, like, you might see it in some people's Instagram bios or whatever, of like, oh yeah, I am INTJ, or I'm ENFP. J, P, whatever. Yeah. All sorts of letter combos. And that is a really popular personality test lately.
It's the MBTI, the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator.
Yeah. And you might have seen it on, like, 16 Personalities, kind of like a little knockoff thing, but that one measures personality in a different way than Ocean does.
Yeah, the Big Five.
So let's take Zenon and myself. So I am an ENFP.
And I am an INTP.
So what this means is, well, we talked about extroversion and introversion. That is would be my E and Zenon's I. And then the next one is intuition or sensing.
So Maddie and I both came out as intuitive, which is about thinking about the future and abstract ideas and possibilities that don't quite conform with reality and daydreaming and that kind of thing.
And then the opposite of that would be sensing. And sensors focus on the present, and they use their senses to gather information and tend to like more practical implications of ideas. The next factor would be feeling versus, prospecting, perceiving. Oh.
No.
You're right.
Thinking and feeling. Yep. Which are pretty straightforward. Thinking, meaning that you prefer to think things through.
Mm-hmm.
Go at a problem with your head. And feeling, where, you know, just kind of follow your heart.
Yeah. I think the best example of this in my case is, I was looking for housing, and, I just kept coming back to this really shitty house, and it had just horrible plumbing, like old carpet and like weird built-in shelves, and like old couches came with it that looked like they had stains all over them. But knowing all of this, the house was purple. And I just saw myself living in a purple house so clearly, and my heart wanted it, but my brain eventually my brain did have to veto that one, but it was a difficult decision. Like, oh yeah, this one has all this new furniture included, and it's like right near Central Campus, but this one
is purple.
It's purple.
Yeah, and your intuitive thinking, future forward thinking self was envisioning yourself in that purple house, whereas someone with, you know, more thinking may just bypass that altogether. And
yeah,
just,
go for the high rise or something.
Exactly. Just look at what gives the most value for the least cost.
Yes.
And kind of go like that. And finally, the last Myers-Briggs indicator is
judging or perceiving. So judging doesn't necessarily mean that you're like an asshole. It's not judging in that sort of way. But judging as in being decisive, being controlled. You often are able to finish tasks by the time that they're due. And then perceiving is a little bit more flexible. You might, you know, take deadlines as kind of a suggestion. You might be a little bit more flexible, more relaxed with your work, that kind of thing.
Yep. So to give it as an example, the Myers-Briggs is a very judging assessment. It wants to put things in one category or another. You are either a J or a P. You cannot be in between. It's one or the other. Whereas the Big Five is more perceiving because it allows for flexibility in different levels of expression of traits.
Very good. Wow. I just brought it all together. However, there is some controversy around the Myers-Briggs, and that's another distinction between the Myers-Briggs and Ocean, is that the Big Five personality, that is, and that's that a lot of researchers trust Ocean as a measure for their experiments and things like that, while the Myers-Briggs is used a lot more casually or in workplaces kind of thing, and that's mainly because it is highly susceptible to change over time when you take it. Like, Zenon, for example, just retook it, and he had a letter change from the last time that he took it.
Yeah.
And personality is something that tends to stay stable over time, as we're going to talk about a little bit in a little bit.
Yep. And another thing with the Myers-Briggs is that it tends to have a bit of a Barnum effect. And what we mean by that is that what it says is broad enough that just about anyone can look at that and say, oh, that's totally me. Like, that's how a horoscope works, is the people who write the horoscopes think, okay, what's something that's probably going to happen to most people in the course of the next week? And then that's what they put down.
You'll have success at work.
Exactly.
You'll find love. But if nothing else, the Myers-Briggs is a really fun way to look at how you interact with other people. Just might not be the best measurement if you're trying to broadly generalize about a whole population or, like,
or, you know, study the effects of personality traits on something as a psychologist. And
right.
Professor Edelstein talks about that a little bit later on.
Yeah, but it is fun for the rest of us if it's something that you haven't really thought about before.
Exactly. Speaking of things we haven't really thought about before, what is personality even? It's a word we use a lot, but how do we really define it?
Yeah, you're right. We do use it a lot in our daily lives. But how psychologists define it is a set of traits that stay pretty consistent across time and across situations.
Yep. And the things that kind of make each person unique and unique in a consistent way.
Right. Something that I found a little bit about while I was doing research for this episode was there are ways that I am like everyone, ways that I am like some people, in ways that I am like nobody at all.
Yep. And that comes from this wonderful little video series we found on YouTube, which will be linked to in the show notes, and in which you can spend about an hour learning everything there is to learn about the basics of personality psychology. And what we're talking about in this episode here is the Society for Personality and Social Psychology, Division 8 of the APA. So that also includes social psychology. So
Maddie, it might seem kind of like, oh, well, why is that one division when personality is something that is so introspective? And then social, well, that's dealing with other people. But that's actually what Dr. Edelstein kind of specializes in, is seeing how our personality traits affect how we interact with others. And the biggest theory to know in thinking about interpersonal relations, how you get along with your loved ones, and your friends.
Yep, and how that relates to personality.
Yeah, and that would be attachment theory.
Yep, so the general idea is that there are 4 attachment types, give or take, with varying levels of security. So starting with the secure attachment type.
With a secure attachment type, you feel comfortable depending on other people and having people depend on you back. So on the other side, there is anxious attachment. And you might have anxious attachment if you feel like you and your romantic partners never get as close as you would really like to be. And you always kind of find yourself wanting more affection, more consistency, things like that.
And that kind of goes hand in hand with ambivalent attachment, where you're not quite comfortable being in a close relationship, so you may get anxious about the relationship, you may feel insecure, you may get angry at your partner for trying to be too close, and the big thing there is inconsistency, so ambivalent, meaning, you know, you go one way or the other. And then the last attachment style that's been identified is avoidant attachment. So that involves just not being that comfortable being in a relationship at all. And that can result from different experiences that have resulted in a lack of trust or not wanting to depend on other people. And
So you tend to be distant in your relationships as well. So we're going to be talking about, can personality change over time? Can your attachment to different people change over time? In our interview with Dr. Edelstein. So, Dr. Edelstein, could you briefly describe your background and your education, or how you got to where you are today?
Sure. So I was an undergrad at UC Berkeley, and I was a psychology major there, and worked in like a bunch of different labs. So I did some work with developmental researchers, I guess some clinical stuff, and got really interested. I worked in a social personality lab and got very excited about it. I just really liked what was going on there. I don't even totally remember what it was, maybe. I think they were looking at like roommate relationships or something like that. And so then I decided I wanted to go to grad school, so I went to UC Davis, also in California, for grad school and studied social personality psychology again. I was actually really initially interested. I think I was always interested in social personality sort of things, but it seemed very impractical to me to do that as like to get a PhD in personality psychology. So I took a psychology in the law class my last year in undergrad and was like, this is great, this is like... So it's basically like how psychological science gets used in the legal system and like could be like studying juries or decision making or eyewitness memory, and I was like, this is great.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Like very practical, super interesting, and so I decided I wanted to study that. And I went to grad school in part to work with someone who was studying children's eyewitness memory for like stressful events.
Okay.
And then, over the years, I got more and more interested in kind of back, I think, to the personality psychology. So, like, why do some people remember things better than others? And sort of less about the applied legal system sort of stuff. And so I sort of gradually worked my way away from there and then got really interested in attachment theory as a way to understand why people remember what they do and how people kind of process information. And that's sort of where I got into attachment theory. And then I just became very, like, more interested in that kind of as a construct and, like, especially avoidant individuals, so, like, people who don't want to get too close to other people, kind of, like, what are they doing? How are they regulating their emotions? Things like that. Feel free to, like, interrupt me. If you have questions, you can stop me. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to just keep talking, but I will.
So it's comforting to hear you say that, like around your senior year of undergrad, you had something that sparked your interest, and we're still able to pursue that.
Definitely. Yeah, I took off a year in between, partly because I was not, I think at, like, most of these steps, like, I wasn't quite ready. Like, I mean, if you really want to go to grad school straight out of undergrad, you need to sort of do it in your junior year, which I don't even think is a thing that is important and necessary, but it wasn't until really senior year that I was like, oh, I think this is the thing I wanted to do, and so I took off a year that gave me some time to, like, apply and take the GRE and everything.
Yeah, just focus on that.
Okay.
Yeah, which I think I would totally recommend, like, even 2 years. Like, I don't know. There's no rush. Like, I think you want to make sure that this is, if you go to grad school, it's, like, really a thing you want to do. Like,
yeah, that's right.
It's a big investment, and it means moving usually, and it's, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah.
So after I got my PhD from UC Davis, and then I did a postdoctoral fellowship at UC Irvine, which is in Southern California. And part of what I was interested in there and what I got to work on was looking at, again, sort of this idea of, like, I got a little bit back into the people's memory for stressful experiences, but then there were people studying how cortisol is related to that. So, like,
okay.
What happens when you're stressed is you have a release of this hormone called cortisol. And sometimes it can help your memory, but sometimes it can impair it. So it seems like, in general, like, low levels of cortisol are good for, like, you know, good for memory, good for, like, getting your body kind of ready for action. But, like, at very high levels, it can impair your memory. So that was kind of my way into, like, the hormone work. And then I got this job here, and there happened to be a lot of people studying other kinds of hormones. And then one of the people who was doing that work ended up leaving, and so left me kind of, like, his lab and some of his students, and I got really into then doing more hormone work, which I hadn't necessarily anticipated, but then finding some really interesting connections between the hormones and relationships and personality and kind of, like, tying that all together. And so I've ended up doing mostly that sort of work, I think, mostly ever since then. So I still do a lot of work with attachment, but often in the context of hormones, and then kind of, like, hormones and relationships sort of more broadly as well.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
All right. So what initially drew you to psychology as an undergrad?
That's a good question. I think I sort of always thought I would probably be a psychology major. I don't know why. I think people are really interesting.
Yeah.
And I was deciding between that and anthropology. I took, I think it was, like, a social anthropology or cultural anthropology. Like, sort of the one, like, where you, like, read books about, like, ethnographies of different cultures. And I thought that was super interesting as well. I mean, I think between the two, psychology seemed, like, slightly more practical. Like, I don't know. Like, I think, anthropology was super interesting as well, yeah. But I think...
Right, it's easy to picture what a psychologist does.
Right? Yeah, and I think I thought, I mean, there must be more career options for a psychology person than an anthropologist. Like, I don't know. I don't know if that's actually even true, but... And it just seemed like also, like, I was interested in psychology more broadly. Like, there was, like, almost every class I took I thought was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I think I've just always been really interested in people and... I find them interesting and confusing and curious, you know, and so I think it was a great fit for me, and I really like the like, sort of scientific approach to it, so sort of, like, the meth, like, I actually really struggled with, like, classes. I never took a philosophy class, but I took a sociology class that I struggled more with it, because I like that psychology is at least, like, sort of trying to empirically test these questions rather than just sort of thinking about things, and not that sociologists...
It's a lot more abstract.
Right. Like, yeah. I don't know that they do experiments, but they do, you know, they do research as well. But I just really liked that combination of trying to, like, learn about people in, like, a systematic way.
Yeah, and it sounds like in your research, too, you get to blend all these different fields of psychology, personality, social, even biological. You know,
which I really like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've enjoyed being kind of at the intersection of a lot of different fields, which sometimes it's easier... to just be, like, in one field kind of more narrowly, but I enjoy it. Like, I get to talk to all the different kinds of people.
Yeah.
Which I like.
Okay. So then, what is it that you do here at the University of Michigan?
What do I do?
Yeah.
I mean, I would say one great thing about this job, sort of the pros and the cons, like, every day is sort of different, and so that...
Okay.
Like, someone was just asking me, like, what percentage of your time do you spend teaching? And it just totally depends. Like, right now, zero. Although I'm still grading. Like, you know, so I think I spend, I don't know, maybe, like, 20-30% of my time, if you think about, like, a year teaching or, like, preparing to teach. So I spend... So not a ton. I mean, when I'm... In the semesters when I'm teaching, it's sort of a lot of time at that point, but, like, we don't teach in the summers. So I teach this big intro to personality class. This is sort of the class that I teach every year. It's like a big sort of the step after intro psych. So it's sort of an overview of the whole field. And then when I can, I occasionally teach a seminar on close relationships. It's like a smaller upper level class, which I really enjoy. And I teach some graduate courses as well. So we have like a graduate program here. And so a lot of actually my time is spent working with my grad students. And so they're helping me with my research. They're doing some of their own research. We spend a lot of time, like, working on writing. So kind of the big thing that we have to do. So regardless of sort of what kind of research you do or what you're doing, you ultimately have to try to publish it. And so like the kind of the end result of all of this is to write papers.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that you sort of learn. It's like you're sort of like an apprenticeship model. Like you learn, the grad students are learning it while they're here. And so a lot of my time is spent like going back and forth with them on like drafts of their papers or helping them or like sometimes writing my own stuff, but more and more kind of like helping them to learn how to do it.
Okay.
And then I would say the other portion, all these sort of change also, like the longer you do it. Like at the beginning, you're doing like mostly research and teaching. And then as you get more kind of, the more you do it, you end up doing more of what's called service. So like I'm on a lot of like committees and I'm trying to think what, like I have like a lot of committees and meetings, but things to like sort of make the area, like the personality area function better. Helping the department, helping like the university or the field or like, and I guess I'll add another thing that has to happen. So we all have to publish these papers, and how that works, there's this thing called peer review, which maybe I don't know if you've heard of this.
Yeah.
And so if I submit a paper, it goes to like three reviewers and they need to read it and give comments and feedback. And that's sort of like part of our job. Like we're not paid for it or really, but like, so I do that for other people and I serve sometimes as like an editor. So when someone submits a paper, like I get the reviewers and things like that. So that can take up a lot of time, but it's like a thing that has to happen.
Yeah, for us to publish our.
Yeah, and it's sometimes kind of like it's a lot of work, but it's sometimes sort of interesting to hear about like this new thing that hasn't been published yet, and you can help people make their work better.
Yeah, you're on the front lines.
Yeah, which is sort of it's fun, but it is it becomes quite time consuming.
Okay. Yeah, and that's actually how we found your name was looking at the website for Division 8 with social and personality psychology.
Oh, interesting.
And we found your name under, I think it was the convention committee.
Yes, yeah, so that is a great example of service. Yeah. And I'm involved in like helping plan the annual meeting for that organization, which is sort of not a ton of work, but like here and there, like I have to sort of pick people who win awards and like figure out policies and things like that. So sort of right now, a lot of like email sort of things.
Okay.
So like, as a professor, researcher, administrative person, like, which part of your job do you find the most, like, gratifying?
It's a good question. I think working with students most of the time, I really enjoy that. Like, sometimes it's the hardest and sometimes the most, like, rewarding. Like, I think, like, seeing them make progress and, like, learn things and, like, enjoy the process and, like, especially with grad students, like, they come in the first year and they're, like, they don't know anything and they're scared and they think they're never gonna, you know. And then by the end, they're, like, you know, they're getting jobs and they're excited. So I do really enjoy that piece of it. I do enjoy, too, like, kind of, like, I like to be able to write when I have time, like, write my own stuff. And I enjoy editing, you know, like, writing papers and stuff. Yeah. So I do enjoy that piece as well. Those are probably my two favorites.
Okay. And then talking about Division 8 of the APA. That's something that, you know, we've kind of been talking a lot about, and that's kind of how the format of our podcast goes. We're going through that list of divisions.
Okay.
And, but one thing that we haven't really been able to figure out too much is, like, what role does that organization serve? What does it do?
So that's really interesting. So I'm not a member of APA.
Okay.
So the Division 8 is not, I'm not even sure I totally understand how it works. Okay. So the Society for Social, SPSV is Society for Personality and Social Psychology, I think is Division 8, but I'm not sure. I think like maybe 20 years ago they branched off and made their own thing.
Really?
And so I think like you can be a member of SPSV and not of Division 8, but I think, I'm not totally sure. So I guess maybe the short answer is I think these societies play a big role, but like APA, I think the societies are important. APA is like this huge kind of umbrella society. I went to the conference a couple of times, like when I was a grad student, and it's like, I couldn't even tell you, like several thousand people. So it's huge. And it's a lot of like, mostly, I think most PhD psychologists are clinical psychologists. And so it's a lot of like clinicians, and it just has a different feel. Like I have a lot of colleagues who go and enjoy it. I have not found much benefit to like being a member of APA.
Okay.
But these other organizations, I mean, it used to be the case that you would, like, get the journal. So, like, if you see all these, like, I can't stop them. Like, I don't want them anymore. Like, you can get them all online, right? Do you want some journal? Like, I mean, as, like, a student, you get access to all of this online. And so it's, like, when I was a grad student, you would, like, get the journal and maybe you'd read it and, like, write in it. And now, like, no one really reads, like, the hard copies. And so you sort of don't need to then be a member of the society to, like,
okay. get that
get those yeah. benefits. And so I think, really, like, you need to be a member sometimes to go to the conference, or it's cheaper. And it is, like, it's like a community. So I think it's okay. helpful to, like, see, like, job ads or, like, people talking about research. But I think, like, APA specifically, I don't think plays, like, a huge role, as big of a role as it maybe used to.
Mm. Okay.
Interesting. Yeah. So what do you see as, like, the implications of things that you find from your research? How do those affect, how does that knowledge become applied, I guess?
Mm, interesting. I mean, it varies a lot, I think, depending on what you're studying. I mean, I think for the things I'm studying, so, like, one project that we did that we've published a couple of papers from is looking at the transition to parenthood and looking at how people's hormones change. And so I think one implication, so one really cool thing that we found is that men show decreases in testosterone during this transition. And I think there's this idea that, like, men should have more testosterone.
Yeah,
there's that's sort of, like, a bad thing. Right. And, like, we find, and, like, lots of other people find, too, that actually it's good. Like, they're better parents. Their partners are happier when this happens. And so
okay.
in some ways, the application could be, like, knowledge that, like this is a good thing.
It's
like,
natural.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And I think also, like, people have taken it, too, to argue that fathers are important, that they're playing this important
yeah.
role. So I think things like that, more, like, education. I mean, we talk sometimes about, are there things that we're learning that we could use to, like, intervene? Because it's, like, a stressful time in couples' lives, but we haven't really taken it to that next step.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that is. Like, kind of informing our knowledge about what parenthood does to parents.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even, like, it's fun just to know things for the hell of knowing them.
Yeah.
So then, kind of taking things back to the bigger level a bit, what do you see as the purpose of social and personality psychology?
Hmm. I feel like there's a couple of different ways you could answer that. I mean, I think psychology as a field, we're really interested in understanding the person and, like, why people do what they do. And mm-hmm. I think both social and personality psychology can tell us a lot about things that are happening in the real world. And so people talk about, you know, why... there's research on, like, bystander intervention, so, like, why people might not stop if they see someone suffering, or why there's, like, prejudice and racism and things like that. So I think just understanding why people do what they do, I think, is certainly of value. And I think each sort of part of psychology has their role to play, but I think the social psychologist, I think, can really speak to, like, why do sort of people on average do things, you know,
yeah.
why... There's interesting work on, like, how does spending money make us happy, or how do certain things make us happy and contribute to, like, stress or happiness, or sort of understanding our emotions. And I think personality psychologists can really be helpful in understanding, are there some people for whom this isn't true, or do some people work differently and things like that. And so I think we can also help understanding relationships and, you know, conflict and why people might have a harder time in marriages than others, and why relationships might change and fail and things like that.
So how has studying personality affected how you view and interact with other people?
I think people have this idea that, like, psychologists and even, like, clinical psychologists, like, oh, you, like, have all the answers, you have it all figured out. I think it just made me very observant and sort of, like I see patterns and I see things, and maybe it's made me also more curious. I mean, I think the sort of interesting thing about being a personality psychologist is that I am interested in the variability. So, like, I think social psychologists tend to be like, oh, this happens because of this. You know, like, I can tell you why this person is attracted to this person, for instance. And I think as a personality psychologist, I'm like, well, that only explains, like, 25%.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's tons of variability, and it makes me actually think about, like, why is that person acting differently, and why? Like, it sort of, I think in some ways it just sort of makes me very curious and attentive to what people are doing, but I don't feel like it helps me necessarily always, like, I think I've gotten maybe, I'm sort of can, like, if I'm that, I can sometimes, like, feel like I'm good at, like, understanding people's behavior a little, or, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think if I'm really any better than anybody else. I think I think about these things a lot, and so I see patterns a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Talking with a guest the other month, we said, like, it's a lot easier to give people the benefit of the doubt, you know, in these
psychology. Yeah, and I think anytime you, like, learn some of these principles, I do think, right, like, even that, like, thinking, like, there's research showing that taking someone else's perspective can be helpful in terms of empathy, and I do think about that sometimes, or sort of, like, one of my colleagues down the hall studies this thing called distancing, where talking to yourself in the third person, like using your own name and giving yourself a pep talk, can be very helpful. And like,
yeah.
I don't know if I like do that, but if I'm doing it, I might like think about it. You know, it's like little tricks that sometimes can be helpful.
Okay. And then in the context of personality psychology, and especially since you look at a lot of things from a biological perspective with hormones and such, do you think that personality traits like attachment style can change?
Yes. So definitely. So I think, there's evidence for both stability and change. So there's like quite a bit of stability, but it's not 100%, right? And so there's certainly evidence that there's continuity from even like infancy, but there's both change, you know? So I think it's hard to, so I think people can take the same data and make, say like, oh, personality is very stable, and the same exact data can be used to argue that there's tons of potential for change. And that, it seems like most of the data too suggests that if your environment is stable, your personality will be more stable. And so some people are also more stable than others. And so I think if you grow up in sort of like a stable household and your parents, you know, stay together and you don't ever move and, you know, there's not a lot of changes, then your personality is likely to stay the same. But if there's like a lot of movement and maybe you're like in and out of a lot of different relationships, then you might show more variability. So definitely potential for change.
So I guess piggybacking off of that, in that same way, could one's, like, attachment style or, you know, behavior and that, could that change between different relationships or friendships?
Definitely. It's not a thing that people really study, unfortunately, and I think they should. But I think, yeah, like, it's certainly malleable, and you can think about how different people bring out different parts of you, you know, and so a certain, you know, so do you know much about attachment, so avoidance and anxiety?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think a lot about how you might not be an anxious person, but certain people can make you very anxious, right? If they're not returning your phone calls and they, you know, they're taking like 2 hours to text you back, like that's going to make you anxious.
Yeah.
And that kind of cycle, you know, can change your attachment style. And also someone being quite anxious too might make you a little bit avoidant, like you need some space. And like, so I think there's a lot of push and pull, and I think certainly, like, a good relationship can make you more secure and less anxious and things like that.
Excellent.
And there's also, one of my former grad students was really interested in lifespan changes, just sort of developmental changes, and he found that, in general, we become less anxious and less, mostly less anxious, but also a bit less avoidant with age, and part of that is relationships, and there's lots of good research on, like, other personality traits that we just become kind of more mature, like less volatile as we get older. Okay. So that's sort of hopeful, I think.
Yeah, you maybe get more perspective.
I think so, exactly.
Experience.
Yeah, and I think also some of the biological mechanisms might kind of calm down a little bit, that's making you more volatile, like hormones.
Oh, yeah. Do you think it's possible to look at one's own relationship or own personality in an objective way, or do we want to see ourselves in a more positive light?
I think both are true. So I think we want to see ourselves positively, but there's going to be individual differences in that as well. But I think, I mean, there's like online tests you can take, and I think most personality constructs, like, we sort of get them intuitively. Like, if, you know, if we talk about attachment anxiety, I can explain it to you, and even you might be like, oh, I don't really want to say that I want to endorse that. But right, like, we can still report on it. And I think, yes, there's going to be some bias, but I think we can have some insight, and I think to the extent that you don't, I think getting input from others and doing some of these tests, I think, can be sort of useful.
Okay.
And it doesn't mean, like, my advisor was one of the people who, like, Phil Shaver, he's one of the people who, like, extended adult attachment into, like, the realm of adulthood, and he would basically talk about how you don't need to understand sort of, like, where it comes from. But we can, like, answer these questions, like, do I feel like people don't get it close, as close as I want to get, or am I anxious that my partner leaves me? Like, I can answer those questions without really knowing, like, where does it come from?
Yeah.
And, like, you know, yeah. what about my childhood?
Yeah.
Like, it's not asking to sort of introspect to that level.
Yeah.
Okay. That's another thing we were kind of wondering about is all those online personality tests that are out there. Like, there's the Big Five, the Myers-Briggs. Like, I guess as a personality psychologist, what do you think of the different widely available personality tests yeah. that there are?
So the Big Five is the one that personality psychologists use. It's sort of, like, freely available, very commonly used. I think there's a lot of good, like, evidence that it's reliable and valid. The Myers-Briggs, so I actually had never even heard of that one until after I'd already gotten this job here. And so,
really?
So yeah, someone, I had a family friend who was using it in, like, a workplace context, and I was like, this is interesting, because, like, I have a PhD in this, and
I've never
heard of it, and so now I know kind of more about it, and I think there's some really interesting articles that I can send you if you can't find them, but, like, on the history of that measure, and it was basically just, like, some women kind of just, like, sitting around thinking about what might some interesting personality constructs be, and they were basing it on, like, Jungian prototypes, but there's just, like, not a lot of, like, research behind it, but it's quite, like, intuitively appealing. Like, people seem to love it, and it, like, I think, as is what I was saying before, people, like, it's like, oh my god, that's totally me.
Yeah.
And, right, so I think it's useful, it seems to be very useful in, like, a organizational setting, and I think also, like, if you're not someone who's ever really given this any thought, you're like, oh my god, like, I am kind of extroverted, and,
yeah.
and, like, so I think for people, like, psychology students or people who think about this, it's like, it's not anything new.
Yeah,
but I think,
oh yeah, I knew that.
Like, yeah, but imagine if you're, like, in, like, an organization, like, in business, and you've never really thought about your personality and how it might interact with someone else's, and it can, like, spark discussion. I think that's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's not, like, a well-validated measure. The thing that also bothers me about it is it's not freely available. So probably you can find it on the internet, but
yeah.
it's, like, you need to be, like, specially trained to administer it. You need to, like, pay for it, which I think is just kind of, like, not... It's sort of, like, anti-science a little bit to me. Like, I think if you want to have a... Like, I think the good measures are sort of, like, ones that can be used and checked and understood.
Okay. I guess to ask about one more, what do you think about the MMPI?
Oh, so that one is... I don't know as much about that one. That one's,
okay.
like, more clinical.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that one is possible is not freely available either.
No, it's
for
not.
Different
it's,
reasons.
It,
yeah,
it's
that's interesting.
Very, very, very
yeah,
heavily
no.
restricted.
We love
yeah.
setting up our laptops and being like, oh, what'd
mm-hmm.
you put for that one? Like,
yeah,
messing
yeah.
around with the personality
yeah.
tests, for sure.
I don't know as much about that one. So that one, I know it's very long. And I think one of the quirky things about that one is they just put a bunch of items, and then they look to see what the answers correlate with. So I think, aren't there items that are like, I like broccoli? And
oh, yeah.
If that's
yeah,
really
kind of
random.
Thing.
It's sort of like this, what's like Dust Bowl empiricism.
Okay.
So I think it's actually like a good measure. I'm just always really wary of anything that you can't access yourself and use, and that people are... I understand that people need to like make a profit on some things, but
yeah.
like if I develop a measure to study something in my lab, you want people to use it. You want
yeah.
to share it and to, like, charge people. It's just sort of not what most scientists are doing. So I don't know. I think that MMPI is actually a good measure,
okay.
but I don't know as much about it.
Let's see. In talking about certain traits as well as how people communicate with one another, what kind of... I guess this is, like, a pretty big question,
mm-hmm.
but what kind of things might influence that feeling of deep connection with another person?
That's, like, a $1 million question.
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, I don't think people know that. Like, I think, like, imagine, like, if dating sites could figure out, like, what...
Oh, yeah.
People want that, like, right? Like, what makes people, like, connect with someone, and I think, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think we know, like, who ends up with whom, right? We know that, like... And I'm not even sure that's... You weren't even asking, like, romantically, necessarily, or were you?
No,
you
no.
Just even,
best,
like, just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Friendships.
I mean, I think, actually, this is where social psychology is really useful, too. I think there's cool research on, like, we end up being close to people who live by us, who are similar to us. And there's... I think, like, there's, like, these cool dorm studies where it's, like, you end up being friends with the person who lives closest to you, the people who live sort of, like, near the common area... have more friends. Like, it's like a proximity, like repeated exposure. And which sort of would suggest you could be friends with almost anyone, you know?
Yep.
So I think, but I don't think in terms of otherwise, like, if you go to, like, a, like in class, like, who you end up, like, connecting with.
Yeah.
I don't know if people know these things. Like, I think that is a big mystery.
Okay.
For sure.
So when you said earlier that people aren't doing very much research on whether or not attachment styles can change, why do you think that is?
I think they're studying whether it changes, like, over time, like, over the lifespan. I think they're not doing it across relationships. My guess is just because it's harder to do.
Like, yeah, hard to like, count for all the...
Because the thing, like, the way we measure it is it's, like, think about your relationships in general, and you fill out this questionnaire. And I actually think that that, in some ways, makes a lot of sense. Because I believe that, like, whatever it is that you're doing, you're probably doing across relationships. Like, I think there's this thing that somehow you got as a child that is, like, fluctuating all the time. But there's some, like, core thing that I think you can tap into when I ask you, like, in relationships or in your current relationship or your last, like, there's some common thing, and then I think also common to, like, I don't know, maybe how you relate to your parents or your sibling. Like, there's some core thing. So I think, in some ways, I think that is fine. But I think if I was actually, like, what if I measured your attachment to, like, your partner and your parents and your siblings and your friends? It's, like, not totally clear what I do with all that information.
Okay.
Like, it'd be cool to have it, but I don't think a lot of people know sort of then how to use it. Because mostly what people do is they measure your, like, attachment style and then use it, like, to predict other outcomes.
Yeah.
And so, but what if, like, you're, you know, more secure in one relationship? Like, it just gets very messy, but I think it'd be super interesting.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, what's the different, like, what's different that makes you anxious in your friendship,
totally,
or secure in your relationship.
Totally, yeah.
So then kind of what's going on with that is that the questions people are asking participants are specifically asking about trends as opposed to specific relationships?
Yes. Okay. So I think there's a few people who are developing measures and studying it in different relationships, but not a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
and certainly, like, I can't think of any study that has looked at, like, you as a person in this relationship and then followed you until you change relationships and then ask, okay, what about this partner? Like, I think that would be super interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think partly it's just that work is really hard to do.
Yeah.
You know, like, you'd have to follow, like, people for a long time and people are breaking up at different times. And
a lot of variables.
Like, I think we've talked before about it'd be cool to get, like, freshmen as soon as they come to college because they're probably, like, breaking up with someone, maybe forming new relationships and, like, but I think it just gets very messy and hard to do, but I think super interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
College age would probably be a really good time to do that.
Yeah.
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 So, like, how do you see your field and what you're studying changing in the next couple of decades? Because we did see some studies about Tinder, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's been a big push, probably something that you guys will learn if you haven't already, as you take more psych classes. Have you heard of this, like, the replication crisis, this sort of...
Yeah.
So I think you'll be hearing more about this, that basically people are having a hard time replicating some of these, like, classic studies. Mm-hmm. And so now I think we're all becoming more aware. Like, even when I talk to you guys, I'm like, who knows? Like, this dorm study, this is probably a thing that was published in, like, the 70s. Maybe on a small sample, who knows? And now, like, has anyone tried to do it again? And so we have all these things that we think are sort of true and that they haven't been replicated, or, like, people are feeling less confident about the science in general, and so people are pushing to, like, do studies with bigger samples and more kind of reliable methods and being more, like, transparent about everything. So I think that will change. I think it'll the pendulum will, like, swing back a little bit, though. I think people are getting a little bit crazed right now. I think there's sort of some people who are like, you can't believe anything, nothing is real.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that, I mean, I feel like we have some solid findings.
Right.
Okay.
And I think, probably, like, more interdisciplinary, I think more sort of talking between fields. I don't know if there'll be major changes. I mean, I'm sure there'll be major changes, but I think some of the technology, like, I don't know that, like, the things that are happening on Tinder are all that different than the things that were happening before we had dating apps. Like, I think people are using dating apps in some ways in really cool ways to look at stuff that is happening in the real world that we wouldn't have access to, like... Like, even that, like, there's, I don't know if you've seen it, there's really cool data from, I think it's, like, OkCupid on, like, who chooses whom and who, like they can see like who gets the most messages, you know, like and I'm trying to think of, like, there's just interesting like trends of sort of like, are people interested in dating someone of their same race or not? And you could ask people. But if you have these kind of data, you can actually see, like, who are they swiping on. And, and that's where I think it can be cool. But I don't know that it's, like, is it, like, changing relationships fundamentally? Like, I'm not sure. Like, it may be changing how people meet. But I don't know that it changes, like, you still have to have that, like, spark, whatever that is. And I guess it's also opening up, though, like, that person might not be your next-door neighbor in the way that they would have needed to be 10 years ago or something like that.
Justin is 27 miles away.
Exactly, right. And maybe, like, more long-distance relationships that weren't possible before.
Yeah.
But I still think there's still, like, some fundamental processes that are still the same.
Right. Like, so once you get there, once you make the connection, like, it's gonna follow
the
pattern.
Right. In some ways, technology, I think, can be helpful in maintaining some of these relationships.
Yeah. Do you think maybe that having access to constant contact with someone has kind of the same effect that proximity did,
totally.
50 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, it's, like, hard to imagine even now, right? Like, if you couldn't, like you had to go home and make a phone call.
Yeah,
and, like,
write a letter.
Yeah. I mean, I think it has changed a lot. I think it's probably in some ways, I think for better or for worse, but I think, it enables you to, like, be away from people and still be connected to them. And I think, I mean, the thing I think about, too, sometimes is I think there's, like, lots of downsides to technology, but it's also given, I mean, imagine people who would have no, like, they'd be very lonely and socially isolated or, like, not have a community or disabled or, like, I think these internet, dark places of the internet also breed bad things, but I think they can also breed this, like, connection and sense of community that you wouldn't have that might not be possible, which I think is cool.
Yeah. I totally agree.
What's one thing you wish you could go back in time and tell your undergraduate self?
Oh, yeah. I think that there's, like, not this huge rush, I think. And I see this a lot with when I talk to students. They're like, I must have a plan by the time I graduate. And I probably things have changed a bit. But I think there's, like, time to figure this stuff out. And that the thing, you don't have to have it all figured out by the time you graduate. And also, like, yeah, I think I felt very stressed about sort of, like, what am I going to do, and what am I going to be, and where am I going to do it, and this will determine everything, and, like, and then, like, you make decisions, and then you change your mind anyway, and it, and I think, too, that, like, there's lots of good options, you know, like, I think you might feel like, oh, I'm debating between, I don't know what to choose, but, like, I think there's lots of good paths that can be fun and good, and you have no way to know, like, what is, like, the right decision.
Right, so going at your own pace.
Yeah, and just, like, having, I guess, some faith that, like, you will figure it out, and
no, that's good to hear. We could probably take that.
Yeah, that's the thing that I see also, where people are just like, "Oh my god, if I have to take off the people." I mean, I know, like, financially things probably have changed. Like, the world has changed, I think, since I was an undergrad. But like people are like, I don't want to start graduate school at, like, 24, and I'm like, it'll be fine. Like, I'm not sure. Like, especially depending on what you end up doing. Like, I see that with people trying to get out of grad school too. Like, it's sort of like all of it is the process, I guess. And, like, so if you start a year or two later, and it doesn't, like, maybe you'll have different, time to do different
things
in your life.
Thank you very much, Dr. Edelstein, and to all of our listeners for joining us on this episode of Preoccupied.
If you like this podcast, please like, share, subscribe if you're listening on a platform. And make sure you share it with your fellow psych students and your teachers and professors for some brownie points. And make sure to tune in next time. Bye.